Her portraits don't do her justice, do they? Sir Alec Arthur murmured in Corin Garvey's ear. I hadn't realized she was so good-looking. Alec, Garvey whispered back, I love you like a brother, but if you say one word to Her Majesty... He let the sentence trail off, and Arthur chuckled. The dashing Duke of Windsor found beautiful women irresistible, and, unfortunately, all too many beautiful women returned the compliment. By Garvey's account, Arthur had fought at least 8 duels with irate brothers, fiancés, fathers and husbands. Of course, those were just the ones he knew about. And since Prince Hector had outlawed public duels over 10 years ago, officially at least, there were probably more that Garvey didn't know about. So far the Earl had managed to survive all of them, and done it without killing anyone and getting himself outlawed in the process. How long he could keep that up was open to question. Besides, Garvey had met Caleb Armack. Any woman he had married was going to be more than a match for Windsor, and that didn't even consider what would happen if Caleb found out about it. "Ah, there's no poetry in your soul, Corin," the Earl said now. "Anyone who could look on that face, and that figure too, now that I think of it, and not be stirred is a confirmed misogynist." Arthur paused, cocking his head to one side. "That wouldn't be the reason your father still isn't a grandfather, would it, Corin? Is there something you've never told me?" I've never told you I was about to kill you until now, Garvey returned repressively. That's subject to change if you don't shut up, though. Bully, Windsor muttered. And party pooper, too, now that I think of it. Garvey's elbow drove none too gently into the Earl's sternum, and he oofed at the impact. All right, he surrendered with a grin, rubbing his chest. You win. I'll shut up. See? This is me not saying a thing. Very peaceful, isn't it? I don't believe you've ever had such a restful afternoon with me around. The second elbow strike was considerably more forceful than the first. Charlian paced calmly up the crimson runner of carpet towards the throne. It was the first time she'd ever been in Mancha, although she had studied this very throne room many times since she had gained access to Owl Snark's. It was rather more impressive in person, though, and much as she had hated Hector Dakin, she had to admit he had had far better taste than the late Grand Duke of Zebediah. Sunlight spilled through tall, arched windows down its long western wall, puddling on the polished parquet floor's inlaid marble medallions and geometric patterns. The wall itself was plastered and coffered, with the personal seals of the last half-dozen princes of Coruscant worked into the recesses between the window embrasures in vibrant colour. And banners hung from the high, spacious ceiling Mancia's near-equatorial climate imposed on local architecture. That vaulted ceiling was also coffered, with polished, richly gleaming wooden beams framing painted panels decorated with incidents from the House of Dakin's history, and the entire eastern wall consisted of latticed glass doors opening onto a formal garden glowing with tropical blossoms and glossy greenery. At the moment she had rather less attention to spare than the architecture and landscaping probably deserved, however, and she concentrated on maintaining her confident expression as she processed towards the dais where the Duke of Anvil Rock, the Duke of Tartarian, and the other members of Prince Davin's Regency Council waited to greet her formally. The remaining members of the Regency Council, at any rate, she reminded herself, a bit tartly. Although, to be fair, Sir Wallace Hillkeeper, the Duke of Craggy Hill, was still technically a member. Changing that permanently was one of the purposes of her visit. It was extraordinarily quiet, quiet enough for her to hear the distant sound of surf through the glass doors which had been opened onto the garden. She had no doubt there were dozens of soft, hushed, side conversations all about her, but these were courtiers, They'd learned how to have those conversations without drawing attention to themselves, and most of them were probably downright eager to avoid drawing her attention at this particular moment. She felt her lips quiver with amusement, and suppressed the thought firmly, continuing her stately, not to say implacable, progress along the carpet. She wasn't as ostentatiously surrounded by bodyguards as she had been in Zebediah, although no one was going to crowd her here either. Sir Corin Garvey's guardsmen lined the throne room's walls, bayoneted muskets grounded, and an honour guard of Imperial Carisian Marines had escorted her from the docks to the palace. She had wanted to insist on a smaller, less obvious and lower-keyed presence, but she had known better. There was no point pretending this was Chisholm or Karis. Not that there'd never been an attempt to kill her in Karis, now that she thought about it. That reflection carried her to the end of the carpet. Merlin Athroyes pacing respectfully at her heels, while Edward Seahamper kept a King Wyvern's eye on the rest of her personal detail, and Sir Rysel Garvey bowed formally to her. "On behalf of Prince Davin, welcome to Mantua, Your Majesty," he said. "Thank you, my lord," she replied. "I wish my visit might have come under happier circumstances. Yet the welcome I've received, not just from you, but from so many of Mantua's people, has been far warmer than I'd anticipated." He bowed again at the compliment, although there'd been a slight double edge to it. For that matter, there'd been a double edge to his greeting. The exact status of Prince Davin remained what diplomats referred to as a grey area, and for all the genuine spontaneity of the cheers which had greeted Charlion, not everyone in the greeting crowds had been cheering. Indeed, she suspected that no more than half of them had, and quite a few of those who hadn't cheered had been stone-faced and grimly silent instead.
"May I escort you to your throne, Your Majesty?" Anvil Rock asked,
and she inclined her head in gracious assent before she laid the fingertips of her right hand on his forearm. He assisted her carefully, and completely unnecessarily, up the five steps to the top of the dais, and she smiled at him before she turned and seated herself. She looked out across the throne room, seeing the faces, trying to sample the emotional aura. It was difficult, despite all the hours she'd spent poring over the Snark's reports from this very city. She felt confident she had assessed Mantua's attitude accurately, at least in general terms, and she knew far more about the aristocrats and clerics thronging this room than any of them could possibly imagine. Yet these were still human beings, and no one could predict human behavior with total assurance. A throat cleared itself quietly to her right, and she looked up at Archbishop Claremont Gairling. He looked back at her gravely, and she smiled and pitched her voice to Carrie. "Before we begin, would you be kind enough to thank God for me for my safe arrival here, Your Eminence?"
"Of course, Your Majesty,"
he agreed with a small bow, then straightened and gazed out across the throne room himself.
"Let us pray," he said.
Heads bowed throughout the vast room, and he raised his voice.
"Almighty God, the high and mighty ruler of the universe, we thank you for the safety in which you have brought our royal visitor to this court. We beseech you to smile upon her and to show her your favor, that she walks always in your ways, mindful of your commands and the dictates of your justice. Guide, we beseech you, all the nations of this your world into the way of your truth, and establish among them that peace which is the fruit of righteousness, that they may be in truth your kingdom, and walk in all the ways you have prepared for them. And we most especially beseech you to look down from your throne and bless your servant Davin, and all who advise, guide, and guard him. Bring him, too, safely back to us, and so resolve and compose the differences between your children that all rulers of clean heart and good intent may gather in the amity your plan has decreed for all men. We ask this in the name of your servant Langhorn, who first declared your will among men to the glory of your name. Amen. That was an interesting choice of phrasing, Charlian thought wryly as she joined the others in touching fingertips, first to her heart and then to her lips. The tightrope here in Coruscant was more complicated than almost anywhere else in the youthful empire of Caris, and Gerling clearly understood that. He'd managed to avoid calling Charlian Coruscant's ruler, and she had noticed the royal visitor, as opposed to the possible imperial visitor. At the same time, he had adroitly avoided calling her an interloper either, and no one could very well take offence at his request for God's blessing on young Davin. And the resolve and compose the differences between your children was straight out of the Church of God Awaiting's most ancient liturgy. Of course, the people who had written that liturgy had never envisioned a situation quite like this one. The stir and shuffle of feet, the rustle of clothing and clearing of throats which always followed a moment of prayer in Charlian's experience, whispered through the throne room. Then Anvil Rock turned towards her and bowed, wordlessly offering her the opportunity to speak without any awkward little formalities which might have conceded or denied her authority to do so. "I thank you for the welcome I received at Dockside this morning," she said, and saw one or two people look up sharply when she avoided the royal we. Well, there'd be time enough for that later. "A Carisian monarch, and such I find I've become, much though the idea would have astounded me as little as 3 years ago." She smiled, and a chuckle ran through the watching courtiers. "Appreciates a welcoming port, especially at the end of a winter voyage, which took rather longer than I might have wished. More than that, I realize how many difficult issues remain between the princedom of Coruscant and the crown of Caris, and I take it as a favorable sign that so many turned out to wish me well upon my arrival here." At the same time, she allowed her expression and her tone to become more serious. "It's obvious not everyone here in Mancha was equally happy to see me." She shook her head. "Under the circumstances, I can scarcely blame anyone who might continue to cherish reservations about the future, and it's only natural such reservations should express themselves in reservations about me and about Emperor Caleb. One of the reasons for Caleb's visit here last year was to attempt to put some of those reservations to rest. That's also part of the reason for my visit this year. Of course," her expression became grimmer, "there are other and less happier reasons as well." It was very quiet in the throne room, and she turned her head, surveying them all, and letting them see her level eyes and firm mouth. "It's never pleasant to be required to yield to force of arms," she said quietly. "Caleb and I understand that. At the same time, I believe any fair-minded person must admit we were left very little choice. When 5 princedoms and kingdoms, including, I would remind all of us, my own, were required by the lords of the temple lands to league together against old Caris, even though that kingdom had committed no crimes or offences against any of them, Caris had no choice but to defend herself. And when it became evident that the corrupt vicars who had seized control of Mother Church intended to continue their efforts to exterminate not just the kingdom of Caris, but any vestige of freedom of thought, the empire of Caris had no choice but to carry the war to its enemies. And so that war came to your shores, behind the banners of my empire." The quiet grew more intense, and she met it squarely, her shoulders straight. "I won't pretend Chisholm lacked its own reasons for enmity with the House of Dakin. I'm sure everyone in this throne room knows what they were and why they existed. But I will say that my enmity, and Caleb's, was directed against the head of that house, and it stemmed from his actions, not from any ingrained hatred of Coruscant or all things Coruscantian. We had specific reasons to confront Prince Hector on the field of battle, and so we did, openly and directly, with none of the diplomatic fictions, lies, and masks the lords of the Temple Lands had employed to hide their crimes." She saw shoulders tighten as she took the bull firmly by the horns. "I realize many continue to believe Caleb ordered Hector's assassination, and I suppose I can even understand why that belief should have gained such currency. But my husband is not a stupid man, my lords and ladies. Do any of you believe for one instant that the son of Harald of Carus could have failed to understand how Prince Hector's murder on the very eve of his surrender would poison the hearts and minds of Coruscantians against him? Can any of you think of an action better calculated to make the peaceful, orderly inclusion of Coruscant in the Empire of Carus more difficult? Having sailed thousands of miles, having won his cause on the field of battle with one overwhelming victory after another, what could possibly have motivated anyone but a bloodthirsty monster to have not only Prince Hector, but his elder son murdered?" She paused once more, for only a heartbeat this time. Then, "You've had the opportunity to see the policies General Sherman has administered here on our behalf, and you know that at the core of those policies lies our desire to demonstrate that the Empire of Carus respects the rule of law and has no desire to rule through terror and the iron fist of oppression. Many of you have had the opportunity to meet personally with Emperor Caleb, and those who have must surely realize that however resolute he may be, however dangerous in battle, he is not and never has been a man who relishes the shedding of human blood. I ask you to ask yourselves, if the crown which dictated those policies and the emperor you met would have resorted to the murder of a foe who had been vanquished and was prepared to offer honorable surrender? An honorable surrender which would have been of far more value to the empire politically, both here in Coruscant and abroad, than his murder, his martyrdom, could ever have been." A half-heard susurration, like a sharp breeze across a sea of reeds, ran through the throne room as more than one of those nobles and prelates realized exactly what she was implying. No one dared speak out in open rejection, however, and she sat silently, letting the thought sink home for a full 10 seconds before she resumed. "I fully realize that the group of four has excommunicated both me and Caleb, and laid the entire Empire of Carus under the interdict," she said then. "As such, in the eyes of temple loyalists, any oaths you may swear to us or to the Church of Carus have no force. Obviously, we disagree, and we have no option but to hold those who swear to the terms of that to which they have sworn. No ruler, even in time of peace, can accept anything less. No ruler, even in time of war, has the right to demand anything more. I'm here in Coruscant in no small part because of that. All of you know what I refer to when I say that. I regret that such a reason should have brought me here, and I regret that many whose only crime was loyalty to Coruscant, to the House of Dakin, and to the clergy they'd been taught to revere, were caught up in the treachery and plotting of a handful of individuals who saw the opportunity to take power into their own hands, for their own uses and their own purposes. I have no choice. Karis has no choice but to exact justice. Yet I will endeavour, as Karis has always endeavoured, to mitigate justice with mercy wherever that may be possible." She paused yet again, the quiet so intense she could hear the surf once more, and the instincts developed in so many years on a throne tried to pass the mood of the people in the throne room. At least some of them seemed to be genuinely trying to reserve judgment, she thought. Others, however assiduously they may try to hide it, had clearly made up their minds already, and weren't about to be swayed by anyone's words, especially hers. She couldn't tell how many fell into which camp, but it seemed to her that the balance was tilted ever so slightly against those who had already committed themselves to hostility. "We've made it clear we aren't prepared to cavalierly strip Prince Davin of his birthright and inheritance," she said finally. "Obviously, when a minor prince is in exile in a foreign court, far from his own lands, we can't simply resign into his hands that which we've won on the field of battle. By the same token, we can understand why Prince Davin and those who genuinely have his best interests at heart should hesitate to deliver him back into the power of those, many believe, had his father and older brother murdered, whether we did or not. Simple prudence would dictate that he not be brought back into our reach until those responsible for guarding his life and well-being are fully satisfied it would be safe to do so. I don't pretend we like the situation, yet I'm also well aware that no one here in Coruscant likes it either. It was the need to bear all of those factors in mind which led Emperor Caleb to recognize the Regency Council as representing Prince Davin, not the Carisian Crown. Obviously, the Regency Council must accommodate itself to the demands of Karis, just as Prince Davin would be required to do were he here and ruling in his own right. That, unfortunately, is the way things work in a world where disputes between realms are too often settled upon the field of battle. It's our hope that in the fullness of time, and preferably sooner rather than later, all these issues will be resolved without further bloodshed here in Coruscant, and we earnestly desire to find in that resolution a way to finally end the anger and distrust, the hostility which has lain between Karis, Chisholm, and Coruscant for so long. In the meantime, we have no intention of expropriating Prince Davin's lands, whether as prince or as Duke of Mantua. Aside from the abolition of serfdom, we have no intention of interfering with Coruscant's traditional law or the traditional rights of her aristocracy or her commons. And aside from those actions necessary to purge Mother Church of the corruption which has infected and poisoned her, the lies which have been told in her name, we have no quarrel with her either, and certainly not with God. And that, my lords and ladies, is what I've come here to Coruscant to demonstrate for all to see. I will make no deals in secret. There will be no secret arrests and executions, just as there have been none yet. We will not torture confessions out of those we suspect of wrongdoing, and if we must inflict the death penalty, it will be carried out quickly and cleanly, without the torture in which Zaspar Clintan delights. In the end, you, as all of God's children, have a choice to make. You may choose to align yourself with the Empire and Church of Karis against the evil threatening to twist Mother Church and all we believe in into something vile and dark. You may choose to stand with Coruscant and the rightful Prince of Coruscant, and it's our hope that in the fullness of time, Prince Davin will choose to stand with us. You may choose to reject the Empire and Church of Karis, and fight them with all your power and all your heart. And that, too, is a choice only you can make. No Carisian monarch will ever seek to dictate your final choice to you, but we will do whatever we must to protect and nurture the things in which we believe, the causes for which we choose to fight, and, if necessary, die. If our choices bring us into conflict, then so be it. Caris will not flinch, will not yield, and will not retreat. As my husband has said, here we stand, we can do no other, and stand we will, though all the forces of hell itself should come against us. Yet whether you make yourselves our friends or our foes, I will promise you this much. The stillness was absolute, and she swept the listening throng with that level brown gaze yet again. We may fight you. We may even be forced to slay you. But we will never torture or terrify you into betraying your own beliefs. We will never convict without evidence. We will never ignore your right to trial and your right to defend yourself before God and the law. Never capriciously sentence men and women to die simply because they disagree with us. And we will never dictate to your conscience or murder you simply for daring to disagree with us, or torture you vilely to death simply to terrify others into doing our will and call that the will of God. She looked out at the silent, listening faces, and her voice was measured, each word beaten out of cold iron, as she dropped her sworn oath into the silence. Those things are what the group of four does, she told them in that soft, terrible voice. And we will die before we become them. 5. Imperial Palace, City of Tellersberg, Kingdom of Old Caris.
I'm going to strangle that parrot, Caleb Armack said conversationally. And if I weren't afraid it would poison me, I'd have the cook serve it for dinner.
The parrot, which had just stolen a pistachio out of the silver bowl on the wrought-iron table, landed on a branch on the far side of the terrace, transferred the stolen nut from its beak to its agile right foot, and squawked raucously at him. Obviously no respecter of imperial dignities, it proceeded to defecate in a long grey and white streak down the lime tree's bark as well. There were quite a few similar deposits decorating the terrace, Caleb noticed. In fact, there were enough of them for at least 2 heroic sculptures, probably even 3, unless they were equestrian sculptures.
With all due respect, Your Majesty, Prince Naaman said, reaching out and scooping up a handful of the same pistachios. First, you'd have to catch it.
Only if I insist on strangling it, Caleb retorted. A shotgun ought to do the job permanently enough, if a little more messily. It might even be more satisfying, now that I think about it.
Zanet would be less than amused with you, Your Majesty,
Duke Grey Harbour pointed out from his seat beside Naaman. The First Counsellor shook his head.
She's turned that dratted bird into her own personal pet. That's why it's bold enough to swoop down and steal your nuts. She's been hand-feeding them to it for months now to get it to ride on her shoulder when she comes into the garden, and it thinks it owns all of them. She'll pitch 3 kinds of fits if you harm a single feather on its loathsome little head.
Wonderful. Caleb rolled his eyes while Naaman and Grey Harbour chuckled. Princess Zenate's 16th birthday would roll around in another few 5 days. That meant she was about 14 and a half old Terran years old, and she was entering what her deceased father would have called her difficult stage. He had used a rather strong term when it had been his older son's turn, as Caleb recalled. Prince Zahn, her younger brother, was only 2 years behind her, but his engagement to Naaman's daughter, Mariah, seemed to be blunting the worst of his adolescent angst. Caleb wasn't certain it was going to last, but for now at least, the assurance that he would, in just over 3 years' time, be wedding one of the most lovely young women he had ever met, appeared to be giving him a level of confidence. The mere fact that his brother was an emperor and that he himself stood third in line of succession wouldn't have. Despite the inescapable political logic of the move, Caleb had had his doubts about betrothing his baby brother to someone almost 8 Seyfholdian years older than he was. But so far, it was working out well. Thank God Moriah took after her mother, physically at least, rather than her father. And it didn't hurt that Zahn was far more inclined to be bookish than Caleb had ever been. Naaman's genetic contribution was obvious in Moriah's keen wits and love affair with the printed page, and she'd been subtly guiding Zahn's choice of books for almost 3 years. He was even reading poetry now, which made him pretty nearly unique among 14-year-old males of Caleb's acquaintance. "Oh, come now," Grey Harbour scolded the Emperor. "I remember you as a teenager, Your Majesty, and I remember your father's description of you just before he sent you off on your midshipman's cruise." "And that description would have been what?" Caleb asked suspiciously. "I believe his exact words were, 'A stubborn, stiff-necked young hellion, ripe for hanging,'" the Earl replied with a smile. "I could be wrong about that, though. It might have been obstinate, not stiff-necked." "Why did everybody who knew me then persist in thinking of me as stubborn?" Caleb's tone was plaintive. "I've always been one of the most reasonable people I know." Grey Harbour and Naaman looked at one another, then back at their liege lord without saying a word, and he snorted. "All right, be that way." He selected one of the roasted salted pistachios, peeled the shell, and popped the nut into his mouth. He picked up another while he was chewing and tossed it at the parrot, which ignored the assault on its dignity with lordly disdain. The Emperor shook his head and turned his attention back to Grey Harbour with a more thoughtful expression. "So you think Corus is seriously contemplating some sort of an arrangement with us?" he asked, carefully projecting a note of scepticism. He couldn't very well tell Grey Harbour he'd been looking over Corus' shoulder, or that one of Al's remotes had been, at any rate, at the very moment the Coruscantian Earl wrote the message Grey Harbour had received.
"I'd say he's definitely contemplating an arrangement, Your Majesty," Grey Harbour replied soberly. "Whether he actually wants to consummate anything of the sort is another matter, of course."
"You're saying you think this is in the nature of a sheet anchor?" Naaman put in.
"Something like that, Your Highness," Grey Harbour nodded. "Whatever else he may have been, Corus was never a fool. I've come to the conclusion that he underestimated you rather badly, Your Highness, but then so did everyone else. And while he doesn't come right out and say so in his note, it has to be obvious to someone as astute and as well informed as him that it would have made absolutely no sense to assassinate Hector and his son."
"I'm not sure I'd go quite that far, my lord," Naaman said thoughtfully. "About its making absolutely no sense, I mean. It would have been uncommonly stupid to have had him assassinated at that particular moment, I'll grant you. But I'm sure quite a few of the world's rulers wouldn't have shed any tears if an enemy like Hector were to suffer a fatal accident after he had sworn fealty and before he could get around to violating that oath."
"All right, that's true enough," Grey Harbour nodded again. "But my point about the actual assassination stands. Not only that, but he has to realize how convenient Hector's murder was from the Group of Four's perspective. Assuming he's genuinely committed to young Davin's well-being, or simply to preserving his own future access to power in Davin's eventual court, he's got to be worried about someone like Clintans deciding that Davin's death might be as helpful as his father's was. So far as that goes, yes,
I'm inclined to think he truly is looking for a way out of Delphirac, if one should become necessary. But you don't think he's going to make a move in our direction unless he does decide it's necessary? Caleb asked. No, I don't. And, to be fair, why should he? It's not as if we've done anything that would endear us to him, and for the moment at least, it's entirely reasonable for his loyalty to Mother Church, as well as whatever personal loyalty he feels towards Davin and Iris, to push him towards staying out of our grasp. He was never as precipitous as Hector, and I don't see any reason for that to change now, especially when he knows that until he's actually forced to turn to us, he's in a far better bargaining position in Tal'Kyra than he'd be in Telesburg. So how do you think we should respond? I've discussed that with Binzamin and also with Alvino, Grey Harbour replied, and Caleb nodded. Binzamin Race wasn't simply old Karras's spymaster, and Alvino Powelson wasn't simply its finance minister. They were also two of Grey Harbour's oldest friends and most trusted colleagues. Both of them agree this is an opening that's far too valuable to pass up, the Earl continued. Obviously, we can't know where it's going to lead, but there's always the possibility it really will end up with Corris forced to seek asylum with us. From a political perspective, it would be impossible to overestimate the advantage of getting our hands, metaphorically speaking, on Iris and Davin. Whether we'd be able to convert that into any sort of willing cooperation on their part is another matter entirely, of course. And given Prince Iris's obvious influence with her younger brother and her evident conviction you did have her father and her older brother murdered, Caleb, I'd say the chances were probably less than even. On the other hand, from all reports, she's smart enough to recognize that whether we're her favorite people in the world or not, her brother probably has no option but to cooperate with us, at least officially. Especially if Corris does believe Clintan had Prince Hector killed, and he's managed to convince her of that. Well, Caleb selected another pistachio and cracked it open. I'm inclined to go along with you, Binzamin, and Alvino. So the next order of business is how we go about moving this courtship along, I suppose. I expect the biggest difficulty is going to be simply communicating back and forth, Naaman said thoughtfully. This isn't exactly something we can discuss with him over the church's semaphore system, and speaking from the perspective of an experienced intriguer, that could be a real problem, especially in a case like this. How long did it take his message to get here, my lord? The better part of 3 months, Grey Harbour's sour tone acknowledged Naaman's point. I can't know what route it followed, but assuming it went downriver from Tal'Kyra to Firaid, or Sarmuth, before it found a ship to bring it to Telesburg, it had over 15,000 miles to travel, which means it actually made excellent time to get here as quickly as it did. But that's the sort of delay that introduces all sorts of potential cooling-off periods into the courtship, Naaman said. And, to be honest, the sort of thing that's most likely to force Karis' hand is also likely to come up in a much shorter time window than that. If he suddenly discovers Davin's in active danger from Clintan, for example, taking 3 months to get a message to us would make it all but impossible to coordinate any effective response with us. A 6 month, two-way communications time? The Emeraldian shook his head. That may work for the normal political seduction, but it won't in any sort of emergency situation. That's true, of course, Grey Harbour admitted. We're still better off than we were, though, Your Highness. Oh, I agree, Naaman nodded vigorously. It's just that I think we might be able to speed up message times, from his end to us, at least. And just how might we accomplish that? Caleb asked, sitting back and looking rather intently at the no longer quite so plump prince. Well, it occurs to me, Your Majesty, that I may have forgotten to mention one small capability of my erstwhile anti-Carisian intelligence service," Naaman said with a charming smile. "As I'm sure you're aware, Emerald's always been famous for its racing, hunting, and messenger wyverns. I do seem to recall something about a wyvern salesman right here in Tellisburg, as a matter of fact," Caleb replied somewhat repressively. "Yes, that was one of our better cover arrangements, I thought," Naaman agreed reminiscently. "It worked quite well for years." "And the reason for this trip down memory lane?" Caleb inquired. "As it happens, Your Majesty, our royal wyvern breeders have been attempting to improve our messenger wyvern stock for quite a long time now, and not simply to help our wyvernry sales. Some years ago, during my father's reign, as a matter of fact, we got a rather unexpected result when we crossed the Dark Hill line from Coruscant with our own grey pattern line. Surely you're not proposing sending Duke Corus messenger wyverns, Your Highness," Grey Harbour said. "That's precisely what I'm proposing, my lord," Naaman replied, and even Caleb looked at him in disbelief. Messenger wyverns had been a part of Safehold's communication system since the creation. Now that he had access to Owl, Caleb also knew the original messenger wyverns had been genetically engineered by Pei Shan Wei's terraforming teams to deliberately enhance the various breeds' natural capabilities for the specific purpose of creating a low-tech means to help tie the original, scattered enclaves together. Bigger, stronger, and much tougher than old Terran carrier pigeons, the wyverns Shan Wei had designed had fallen into two main categories, either of which would carry considerably heavier messages than their tiny old Terran counterparts. They could even be used to carry small packages, although it wasn't the most reliable possible way to deliver them. The short-range breeds were faster, smaller, and more maneuverable than their larger brethren. Capable of speeds of up to 60 miles per hour, although some of the racing breeds had been clocked at over 100 miles per hour in a sprint, their maximum effective flight range was mostly under 600 miles, which meant they could deliver a message to their maximum range in as little as 10 or 11 hours on average. They were the most commonly used breeds, in large part because the logistics meant there was little call for ranges longer than that. Like carrier pigeons, they were a one-way communication system, since they returned only to the wyvernry they recognized as home, wherever that might be, which meant they had to be transported from their home to their point of release. Shuttling them back and forth by wagon or on lizard back over distances much greater than 600 miles simply wasn't practical for most people. Although the church and some of the larger mainland realms maintained special relay systems to supplement and back up the semaphore towers. In addition, and unlike carrier pigeons, they could be relatively quickly imprinted with another home wyvernry. In fact, it was necessary to take precautions to prevent that from happening inadvertently. The longer-range wyverns were slower, but they also were capable of flights of up to 4,000 miles. Indeed, there were rumors of legendary flights of up to 5,000, although substantiation for such claims was notoriously thin on the ground. Because they were slower, and because they had to stop to hunt and roost on the way, they were capable of no more than 750 miles per day under average conditions, but even that meant they could deliver a message over a 4,000-mile transit in less than 6 days. That was slower than the semaphore, under good visibility conditions anyway, but faster than any other means of communications available, at least to those who didn't have the advantage of communicators and satellite relays. As Regis just pointed out, it's 15,000 miles from here to Talkeira by ship and boat, Caleb said. I realize it's shorter than that in a direct line, but it's still close to 7,000 miles, even for a wyvern, Naaman.
Yes, it is, Naaman agreed.
And it just happens. I have at my disposal a breed of messenger wyvern capable of making flights at least that long.
I find that difficult. Not impossible, Your Highness. Just difficult to believe,
Grey Harbour said after a moment.
If we really do have wyverns with that kind of range, however, I'm entirely in agreement with you. The question becomes how we get them to Duke Corus in the first place.
I've been thinking about that too, my lord, Naaman said with a smile.
And I think I know just the messenger, assuming we can contact him.
He glanced at Caleb, who raised his eyebrows.
And exactly who were you thinking about calling upon? The Emperor inquired politely.
It just occurred to me, Your Majesty, to wonder if you might have some means of getting into contact with Sajin Merlin's friend, Master Zevons.
Naaman smiled toothily at Caleb's expression.
He did so well at motivating King Gorgia, and he's obviously at home operating on the mainland. It just seems appropriate somehow to get him into touch with Duke Corus as well. Who knows?
His smile faded suddenly, his eyes meeting Caleb's levelly.
It might just turn out that this is another situation that requires his special talents, Your Majesty.
6. City of Gorath, Kingdom of Dolar, and Royal Palace, Princedom of Coruscant.
They're here, my lord, Lieutenant Bardalen said quietly.
Thank you, Arbail, Lewis Gardner said.
He inhaled deeply, squared his shoulders, and turned his face to the cabin door.
Show them in, please.
Yes, my lord.
The flag lieutenant bowed considerably more deeply than usual and disappeared. A moment later, he returned.
Admiral Manthir, Captain Brayshare, and Captain Kruger, my lord, he announced unnecessarily,
and Gardner bobbed his head to the newcomers.
"Gentlemen," he said. "Duke Thirsk," Gwilym Manthir replied for himself and his subordinates. "I very much regret the necessity to summon you to this particular meeting," Thirsk said levelly. "But in the name of what honor remains to me, I have no choice. Admiral Manthir, you surrendered your ships and personnel to me after a most gallant and determined defense, one which still commands my admiration and professional respect. At that time, I promised you honorable treatment under the laws of war. I regret that I face you as a man forsworn."
Bardalen shifted slightly, face tightening in silent protest, but Thirsk continued in the same measured tone.
"I'm sure you recognized, as did I, that any promise on my part was subject to violation or outright revocation by my superiors or by Mother Church. As a loyal son of Mother Church, it's not my place to criticize or dispute her decisions. As an officer of the Royal Dalaran Navy, I am ashamed."
He looked directly into Manchir's eyes, hoping the Carizian saw the truth in his own.
"Your men have been badly enough abused in Dalaran custody. The fact that I've done everything in my power to alleviate that abuse is no excuse for my failure to change it, nor will anything remove the stain of that abuse from the honor of my navy. I once thought harshly of your emperor and the terms he enforced upon my men. Had I known then how you and your men would one day be treated by my own service, I would have gone down on my knees before him to thank him for his leniency."
He stopped speaking, and silence lingered in the wake of his final sentence. Several seconds passed, and then Manthir cleared his throat.
"I won't pretend I'm not angry over the way my people have been treated, my lord."
He held Thirsk's gaze, and his eyes were as hard as his tone was flat.
"God alone knows how many of those who died in the hulks would have lived if they'd been given proper food and even minimal medical care.
and that doesn't even consider the fact that now your navy is prepared to turn us over to the Inquisition in full knowledge of what will happen." He saw Thirsk wince, but the Dalaran admiral refused to look away or evade his flinty eyes, and after a moment it was the Corisian who nodded ever so slightly. "I won't pretend I'm not angry," he repeated. "And I won't pretend I don't agree that this is going to be an indelible stain on the honor not just of the Dalaran Navy, but of your entire kingdom. The time will come, my lord, when you and all Dalarans will rue the way in which my men have been treated. I won't be here to see it, but as surely as the sun rises in the east, my emperor will see justice done in our names, just as he did in Farad. It might be well for your king to remember that day, because this time there will be no question as to where the final responsibility lies. Yet while all of that's true, and while I have no doubt history will besmirch your name as surely as that of the Duke of Fern or King Ranild, I also know you personally did everything humanly possible to honor your word to me and to see my men decently and honorably treated. I can't forgive you for the cause you serve, but I can and will say you serve it as honorably as any man living could." "It's not given to us to choose the kings we're born to serve," Thirsk replied after a moment. "And honor and duty sometimes lead us places we wish we'd never had to go. This is one of those places and one of those times, Admiral Manchir. Yet I am a Dalaran. I can't change the decisions which have been made by my king, and I won't break my oath to him. But neither can I hide behind that oath to evade my responsibility or hide my shame from myself or from you. And that's also the reason I asked you here this morning, so that I might apologize to you personally, and through you to all of your men. I know it means very little, but it's all I have to give, and the least I can give." A part of Sir Gwilym Manthyr wanted to spit on the deck, wanted to curse in Thirsk's face for the sheer uselessness of words against the scale of what was going to happen to his men. Words were cheap. Apologies cost nothing, and neither of them would save a single one of his men from a single second of the agony waiting for them. And yet, Manthyr drew a deep breath. Perhaps Thirsk's apology was no more than a gesture. Yet both of them knew how dangerous a gesture it was. There was no way the Inquisition could fail to learn of this meeting, and given Thirsk's efforts to protect his Corisian prisoners while they were in his custody, the Inquisitors were unlikely to look kindly upon it. For the moment at least, Thirsk was too important, probably, to the Church's jihad to find himself the Inquisition's guest. But that was always subject to change, and both of them knew how long a memory Zaspar Clintan had. So gesture though it might be, it was scarcely as empty as some might think. "I'm no nobleman, my lord," the Corisian said bluntly. "I don't understand all the ins and outs of a noble code of conduct. But I do understand duty, and I do know you've truly done all you could. I can't absolve you of the guilt you obviously feel. I don't know if I would if I could. But I do accept your apology in the spirit in which it's offered, and I hope that when the bill finally comes due for what your kingdom and the Inquisition are about to do, your efforts to do the right and honorable thing will be considered in your favor. You may not have been born a nobleman, Admiral, but at the moment I think that's a mark in your favor." Thirsk smiled humorlessly. "Perhaps if I weren't quite so pig-headed, we—" He broke off, waving one hand, then glanced at the clock on the cabin bulkhead and his jaw tightened. "I'm not supposed to know, Admiral, but you have approximately 4 hours before your escort arrives." He saw Manthyr's face turn to stone, but went on unflinchingly.
Lieutenant Bardalen will return you to the prison ships. If any of you wish to send a last letter home, I give you my word I'll personally see it delivered somehow to Caris. Please see to it that any letters are completed at least a half hour before the Navy is required to transfer you to your escort. Leave them aboard ship when you depart, and I'll have them collected in a day or two. After the Inquisition's taken you all away, and I can do it without having my own men and me sent to join you. He didn't say out loud, but Manthea and his two captains heard it anyway.
I thank you for that, my lord.
For the first time, emotion softened the flint of the Carisian's voice. I hadn't expected it.
I only wish I'd thought...
Thirsk began, then stopped. I only wish I'd found the courage to make the offer sooner, Admiral, he admitted. Now go, and whatever the Inquisition may think, may God be with you.
So, you're Admiral Manthea, the Shularite upper priest sneered.
Sir Gwilym Manthea only gazed at him wordlessly, eyes contemptuous. It was an almost obscenely beautiful day, given what was happening. The air was cool, the breeze refreshing, and the solid quay underfoot seemed to undulate gently. After so long in the hulks, it was going to take him some time to get his land legs back. Sea birds and sea wyverns swooped about in their unending sweeps of Garth Bay. There was always some interesting bit of garbage, some piece of flotsam, some unwary fish, or the eyes of some drifting Carisian corpse to attract their attention, and he realized he was going to miss their antics once they'd left the harbor behind. Funny, he hadn't thought there was anything he'd miss about Garth Bay, but that was before the coin had finally dropped.
"Proud and silent, are you?" the Shularite observed, and spat on the ground just in front of Manthea's feet. "We'll see how silent you are when you reach Zion, heretic."
The upper priest was in his 40s, Manthea estimated, with dark hair and a close-cropped beard, and a coiled whip hung at his side. His brown eyes were hard, dark, and hating, which was scarcely a surprise. Zaspar Clintan would have hand-picked the man responsible for delivering his latest victims.
"The Grand Inquisitor wants you in Zion in one piece," the Shularite continued. "Personally, I'd just as soon shoot all of you and leave you in the ditch like the carrion you are, but that's not my decision. What is my decision is how discipline will be maintained on our journey. I'd advise you all to remember my patience is short, and the men under my command understand how to deal with Shanwe's get. Take that as all the warning you'll be given."
Manthea simply looked back at him, refusing to flinch or look away, yet able to picture the thin, wasted, raggedly dressed officers and men standing behind him on the quay. He and the Shularite both knew they'd heard every word, but he felt their angry, hopeless defiance at his back. The Shularite glared at him for another minute, then turned his head.
"Captain Zoo," he barked.
"Yes, Father Victor," a shortish, blocky officer in the uniform of the Temple Guard replied.
Captain Zoo was obviously Harchungian, with the strongly pronounced epicanthic fold of his people. He looked to be in his late 30s, with black hair, and his guard uniform bore the sword and flame of the Order of Shula as a shoulder patch. That indicated that while he was a guard officer, he'd been seconded to the Inquisition, which probably made sense. The Inquisition had its own small, highly trained military force, but it specialized in enforcement, not in field exercises. For an overland journey this long, they'd want someone with experience handling troops in the field.
"Put this garbage in its cages," Father Victor gestured contemptuously at the Carisians. "And I don't see any need to be overly gentle with them."
"As you say, Father," Zhu agreed with an unpleasant smile, and turned to the weathered-looking, squatly muscular sergeant at his heels.
"You heard the father, Sergeant Zadang. Get them moving."
"Yes, sir."
"Well, I suppose this settles what I can and can't do after all," Merlin Athroys thought grimly, lying back in his borrowed bed in Manchir's royal palace, and watching through the snarks as the Carisian prisoners were driven aboard the wagons prepared to receive them. The temple guardsmen were equipped with heavy, massive, old-style matchlocks, not the newer flintlocks which were beginning to trickle into the temple's service, and they plied their musket butts freely. He watched Carisian seamen stagger as those musket butts slammed home between their shoulder blades or drove into their ribcages. More than one man went to his knees, to be kicked and beaten until he managed to claw his way back to his feet, and if any of his comrades tried to help him, they received the same treatment. Merlin's sapphire eyes opened in the early morning darkness, hard with fury, as a young one-legged midshipman fell. No one had struck him. He simply tripped as he tried to move fast enough to satisfy their captors on his single foot and obviously jury-rigged crutch. It didn't matter. The guards closed in, battering and kicking while the boy curled in a desperate protective knot, trying to protect his head with his arms, and Merlin's jaw clenched as Sir Gwilym Manthyr deliberately stepped into that ring of sadistic blows. He watched the muscular admiral taking the musket butts on his own back and shoulders, never raising a hand against his assailants as he was battered to his hands and knees across the boy's body, only using his own body to protect that fallen midshipman. Then there was another man inside that circle, one in what was left of the uniform of a Carisian captain, and another man, slightly built, with a waxed moustache, who Merlin recognized as Niklas Wallén. The guards beat and kicked them harder than ever, but a handful of seamen joined them. More than one of them went down only to rise again, faces bloodied, bodies bruised, taking those blows with silent defiance, until Manthyr could climb back up from his own knees and take that semi-conscious young body in his arms. Another musket crashed into the admiral's kidneys, and he stumbled forward, face twisted with pain, but he refused to drop the midshipman. One of the guards raised his musket high in both hands, obviously aiming a murderous buttstroke at Manthia's head, and the admiral glared at him, eyes of fire, hard in a blood-streaked face, daring him to strike. The blow started forward, only to stop in mid-air, stop so abruptly the guardsman staggered, as an auburn-haired guard lieutenant shouted an order. The entire scene froze, and then, grudgingly, the guardsman stepped back and allowed the fallen to rise. There were still blows, still shouted obscenities, still sneering promises of worse to come, but at least Manthyr was allowed to carry that slight fallen body to the waiting transport wagons. The wagons were big enough for 15 or 20 men to be crammed aboard with room for perhaps 6 of them to lie down at any given moment. They were heavy-framed, without shock absorbers, springs, or anything resembling seats, sided with iron bars and roofed with iron gratings. They were basically dungeon cells on wheels, and the only overhead cover was in the form of canvas tarps, which were currently tightly rolled and stowed beneath the driver's tall seats. Each wagon was drawn by 2 hill dragons, the size of terrestrial elephants, but with longer bodies and 6 powerful legs each. They were capable of a surprising turn of speed and possessed excellent endurance. The wagon doors were slammed and locked. Orders were shouted, and the convoy lurched into motion. There was no reason those wagons had to have been built without springs, Merlin knew. They'd been built that way deliberately, with only one object in view, to make any prisoner's journey as unpleasant as possible, and to show any witnesses how unpleasant that journey was. which is the entire reason they decided not to send them by water after all, Merlin reflected bitterly. They're sending them the long way by land, so they can stop in every town to display their prizes, give every village the chance to watch them roll through on their way to the temple and the punishment of Shula. They're too damn valuable an object lesson for Clintan to waste sending them by sea, and God knows how many of them are going to die on the way. And there's not one damn thing I can do about it. I can't even sink them at sea to spare them from what's waiting. He watched that clumsy procession of iron-barred wagons lurching slowly northward from the city of Gorath, and hated his helplessness, as he'd seldom hated anything in Nemu Alban's life, or his own. Yet while he watched, he made himself one solemn promise. Sir Gwilym Manthir was right. What had happened to the city of Farad was nothing compared to what was going to happen to the city of Gorath. 7. Royal Palace, City of Manchir, Princedom of Coruscant. It wasn't the throne room this time. In many ways, Charlian would have preferred that venue, but there were traditions to break. Prince Hector's notion of judicial procedure had been to see to it that the accused got the proper sentence, not to worry about any pettifogging legal details like proving guilt or innocence. Trials were an inconvenient, messy formality, which sometimes ended with the accused actually getting off entirely, which was scarcely the reason he had had the culprit arrested in the first place. Far more efficient and direct to simply have him hauled in front of the throne and sentenced without all that unnecessary running around. To be fair, the majority of Hector's subjects had considered his justice neither unduly capricious nor unnecessarily cruel. He had maintained public order, prevented the nobility from victimizing the commoners too outrageously, supported the merchants' and bankers' property rights and general prosperity, and seen to it that most of his army's killing had been done on someone else's territory. Theoretically, there had always been the appeal to the church's judgment, although it had been resorted to only infrequently, and usually unsuccessfully. But by and large, Coruscantians had assumed anyone Prince Hector wanted to throw into prison or execute, probably deserved it, if not for the crime of which he stood accused, for one he had committed and gotten away with another time. What that also meant, unfortunately, was that being hauled in front of the prince had been tantamount to being punished. And what that meant, in turn, was that if Charlian dispensed justice from the throne room which had once been Hector's, those being brought before her would automatically assume they were simply there to learn what fate had already been decreed for them, and that justice actually had very little to do with the process. All of which explained why she was, instead, sitting in the magnificently, if darkly panelled, Princess Aletha's ballroom. Charlian couldn't imagine anyone voluntarily holding a ball in the room. Only one wall had any windows at all, and they were small. Not only that, but more recently constructed portions of the palace cut off most of the light they would have taken in anyway. She supposed the vast, gloomy chamber would have looked much more imposing with its dozen massive bronze chandeliers all alight, but the heat from that many candles would have been stifling, especially in Manchir's climate. Probably just that northern blood of yours talking, she thought. As far as these people are concerned, it might simply have been comfortably warm, maybe even bracingly cool. No, she had decided, not even Coruscantians could have done anything but swelter under those circumstances. She was dithering, she told herself, looking out across the rows of benches which had been assembled to face the dais upon which she sat. The main reason she had chosen Princess Aletheia's ballroom, aside from the fact that it wasn't the throne room, was its size. It was stupendous, bigger than any other chamber in the palace complex, and almost 500 people sat looking back at her, across the open space, cordoned off by Sir Corin Garvey's guardsmen. There were nobles, clerics, and commoners in that crowd, chosen to make it as representative a mix of the population as possible, and some of them, not all commoners by any means, seemed acutely uncomfortable in their present surroundings. Perhaps some of that might have been due to the 6 members of the Carisian Imperial Guard, who stood between them and her dais on either side of Edward Seahamper, or, for that matter, to the way Merlin Athroyes loomed silently, somberly, and very, very intimidatingly at her back. The dais raised her throne approximately 3 feet, and it was flanked by only slightly less ornate chairs in which the members of Prince Davin's Regency Council were seated. 2 more chairs, remarkably plebeian compared to the Regency Council's, sat directly before the dais at a long table placed just behind the line of guardsmen and piled with documents. Spinesair Arnold, her bespectacled, youthful secretary, sat in one of those chairs. Father Nathan Zandor, bald head shining above its rapidly retreating fringe of brown hair, even in the ballroom's subdued light, occupied the other. Archbishop Claremont was also present, but he had chosen to stand to Charlian's right rather than be seated himself. She wasn't certain why he had made that choice. Perhaps it was to avoid giving the impression he too was seated to give judgment ex cathedra, adding the church's imprimatur to whatever judgments she rendered. Yet his position might also lead some to think he was standing as her adviser and counsellor. "And he's going to get damn tired before the day is over," she thought grimly. "Still, I suppose we'd best get to it." She raised one hand in a small yet regal gesture, and a shimmering, musical note rang through the enormous room as Arnold struck the gong on one end of the document-piled table.
"Draw nigh and give ear," a deep-voiced chamberlain, a Carisian chamberlain, bellowed. "Give ear to the crown's justice."
Utter silence answered the command, and Charlian felt the stillness radiating outward. Many of the people seated on those rows of benches would normally have been chattering away behind their hands, eyes bright as they exchanged the latest delicious gossip about the spectacle they were there to see. But not today. Today, they sat waiting tensely until the double doors of the ballroom's main entrance swung wide and 6 men were marched through them, surrounded by guards. The prisoners were richly dressed, jewels sparkling about their persons, immaculately groomed. Yet despite that, and even though they held their heads high, there was something beaten about them. And well there should be, Charlian reflected grimly. They'd been arrested over 6 months ago. Their trials had been concluded before a combined panel of prelates, peers, and commoners 2 5 days before she ever arrived in Mantua, and they could be in little doubt about the verdicts. They halted in front of her, and to their credit, she supposed, 5 of them looked at her squarely in the eye. The 6th, Sir Zer Somers, the Baron of Barcourt, refused to raise his own eyes, and she saw the gleam of perspiration on his forehead. Arnald pushed back his chair and stood, taking the top folder from the stack in front of him and opening it before he looked at Charlian.
"Your Majesty," he said, "we bring before you accused of treason Wallace Hillkeeper, Duke of Craggy Hill, Brian Selkier, Duke of Deep Hollow, Salaam Tregair, Duke of Storm Keep, Sir Adolfo Linkin, Duke of Blackwater, Razier Merwin, Baron of Larcross, and Sir Zer Somers, Baron of Barcourt.
Have these men been given benefit of trial? Have all of their rights under the law been observed?" Her voice was chill, and Zander stood beside Arnald.
"They have, Your Majesty," he replied, his deep voice grave. "As the law requires, their cases were heard before a court of church, lords, and commoners, which determined their guilt or innocence by secret ballot, so that none might unduly influence the others. Each had benefit of counsel. Each was allowed to examine all the evidence against him, and each was permitted to summon witnesses of his choice to testify on his behalf." There was no hesitation or question in that voice, and Charlian heard one of the accused, Bachor, she thought, inhale sharply. Father Nathan Zandor wasn't just any lawmaster. He'd been picked by Michael Stainer for this mission because of his reputation. A Langhornite, like most lawmasters, he was, or had been before the schism at least, widely acknowledged as one of Safehold's two or three most knowledgeable masters of admiralty and international law. If Father Nathan said all of their rites had been observed, that was that. Upon what grounds were they accused of treason?
"Upon the following specifications, Your Majesty," Zandor said, opening a folder of his own. "All stand accused of violating their sworn oaths of fealty to Prince Davin. All stand accused of violating their sworn oaths to the crown of Kairis, freely given after Coruscant's surrender to the Empire. All stand accused of raising personal armies in violation of their oaths to the crown of Kairis, and also in violation of the law of Coruscant, limiting the number of armed retainers permitted to any peer of the realm. All stand accused of trafficking and conspiring with the condemned Thomas Simmons of Zebediah. All stand accused of plotting insurrection and armed violence against Prince Davin's Regency Council and against the Crown of Kairis. In addition, Duke Craggy Hill stands accused of violating his personal oath and abusing and betraying his authority and position as a member of the Regency Council in the furtherance of their conspiracy and his own quest for power."
Stillness crackled in the ballroom, and Bachor licked his lips. Craggy Hill glared at Charlian, but it was an empty glare, little more than surface deep, for something darker and far less defiant lived behind it. "And has the court which heard their cases reached a verdict?"
"It has, Your Majesty," Arnald said.
He turned the top page in the folder before him. "Wallace Hillkeeper, Duke of Craggy Hill, has been adjudged guilty of all charges brought against him," he read in a flat, carrying voice. Then he turned a second page as he had the first. "Brian Selkir, Duke of Deep Hollow, has been adjudged guilty of all charges brought against him." Another page. "Salaam Treger, Duke of Stormkeep, has been adjudged guilty of all charges brought against him." Another whisper of turning paper. "Sir Adolfo Linkin, Duke of Blackwater, has been adjudged guilty of all charges brought against him. Razier Merwin, Baron of Lacros, has been adjudged guilty of all charges brought against him. Sir Zir Sumirs, Baron of Barkor, has been adjudged guilty of all four of the five charges brought against him, but acquitted of the charge of personally trafficking and conspiring with Tommy's Simmons." The last page turned and he closed the folder. Then he turned and looked up at Charlian. "The verdicts have been signed, sealed, and mutually witnessed by every member of the court, Your Majesty.